Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I welcome you and our viewers on Shaw Cable TV. My name is Dwayne Pendergast. I'm the moderator for today's session of the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. There's a little housekeeping here. There's a basket on your table to collect $10 payment for lunch. And please assign an auditor to ensure the correct totals available for collection. SACPA is a nonprofit organization and relies on the contributions of members and session attendees to continue its work. So we won't let any of you out without paying. I also thank SACPA's sponsors, the University of Lethbridge, the Lethbridge Herald, and Shaw TV for their support, and Erickson's Restaurant for preparing our lunch. Most of you know the procedure we follow. For the sake of new participants, I note we start with the 25 to 30 minute presentation, then we serve lunch, and we'll proceed with the 30 minute question period at about 1 o'clock or shortly before. Our topic today is nuclear energy right for Alberta or not? Alberta's oil and gas resources have been very much in the news this summer, particularly the last few days. Some say the royalties we are paid for them are too small and development is too fast. Industry claims that higher royalties will drastically dampen development. Entrepreneurs propose to build nuclear power plants in northern Alberta to help with the extraction process and extend oil sand resources. Some others are adamantly opposed to that, and who are we to believe? Eric Williams has come to tell us of his experience with nuclear energy. Eric and his nuclear family lived near and worked at the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station in rural Ontario for 35 years. Eric holds an engineering degree from the University of Waterloo and is a registered professional engineer in Ontario. Recently retired, he's now the president of the Canadian Nuclear Society. He and his wife, Linda, continue to live in Tiverton, one of the several small towns near the Bruce nuclear facility. His son, Brent, has carried on the family tradition, and he's now an engineer at Bruce. He lives nearby as well and is also president-elect of the North American Young Generation in Nuclear. Eric's daughter, Larissa, is a social worker living in Ottawa. Finally, Eric is a lay reader for the Anglican Church of Canada, an active Scouts Canada leader, an ardent canoe tripper, and past president of Paddle Canada. Please welcome Mr. Williams.
Thank you very much, Dwayne, for that generous and probably too long introduction. My presentation today will include a few words about the Canadian Nuclear Society, a brief review of the world energy picture today, a layman's explanation of the nuclear energy process, and to do that I have a few slides I'd like to share with you, and a brief closing summary about life in a nuclear community. I understand I have about 25 minutes to do this, and that I don't want to keep you from lunch at the end of it all. The Canadian Nuclear Society is the people behind the nuclear industry in Canada. It's comprised of engineers, scientists, designers, professors, interested public, the media, and the decision makers who, for the most part, make up the backbone of the Canadian nuclear industry. The CNS is an incorporated, not-for-profit society, and it's not constrained or mandated by any government regulations. The CNS provides information on the nuclear technologies and cannot support or lobby for any specific application or use. You Albertans are the only ones that are going to be able to decide the question, which is the title of my presentation today. What I can do in the next 25 minutes is tell you a little bit about the process, its performance, the expectations and experiences of others, and provide you with some contact references to help you make an informed decision on this matter. I think the CNS is well positioned to do this. The CNS focuses on information exchange, on the applied nuclear sciences and technology. Nuclear energy, uranium, fission, and other nuclear technologies such as occupation and environmental protection, medical diagnosis and treatment, the use of radioisotopes, and food irradiation. The CNS's objectives are to act as a forum for the exchange of information, to foster the development and beneficial uses of the nuclear sciences and technology for peaceful purposes, to encourage education and knowledge in the nuclear sciences and technologies, and to enhance the professional and technical capabilities of those involved with the industry. To do this, we run a series of technical courses for the industry. These include things like reactor safety, steam generator maintenance, etc. We facilitate conferences to get together, share recent operating experience, and I'm pleased to announce that the 2009 Calgary conference is scheduled for Calgary in June. We maintain an information website, we publish technical bulletins, and we support about 13 branches across Canada to try to make a presence in the local areas. We are a member of the Canadian Nuclear Association, which is the companies behind the nuclear industry in Canada, and we also actively interface with kindred societies at home and around the world. I understand that it takes the energy equivalent of about one barrel of oil in order to refine and extract two barrels of oil. Given the large impact of the tar sands and the shale oil projects on the local environment and the cost associated with it, I would suggest it may be worth considering an option which would stretch those resources significantly while slowing the physical and environmental impacts on Alberta, and all at a cost-competitive cost. Alberta needs safe, clean, green, recyclable energy. Let's look back for a minute. Where have we got our energy in the past? Wood has been the mainstay sort of in memoriam. Still, some of us are using it for heating our homes and things. Coal, which peaked in 1940 and was about 70% of the demand then, has been on the decline. Oil peaked about 1975 and at its peak supplied about 35% of the demand and is in decline as it gets harder to get. Gas is expected to peak in about 2030 and to be about 65% of the demand at that time. Uranium has been a contributor since 1960s. It's still on the increase and currently supplies less than about 10% of the energy needs of Canada. Hydraulic, geothermal, wind, solar, and wood are currently supplying about 9% of the energy supplies in Canada. Fusion is expected to become a contributor in future generations, and the predictions are that once that's realized, the energy supply will be virtually limitless. Energy consumers, we know, are industry and manufacturing, somewhere around 32%, transportation, somewhere around 28%, commercial, 18%, and residential, about 22%. But the times are changing. Petroleum, which has been the mainstay of our energy supply for the past 100 years, is playing a declining role. Nuclear fission has been a minor supplier to date, but it really can't remain so any longer. North America has been energy rich in the past. We are not today, and it's not going to improve. Fossil fuels increase the world's greenhouse gases, and this is a strong motivation to reduce their impact and use. The oil and gas market will drive the transition to nuclear energy, and the tar sands could be a prime driver here in Alberta as the later part of the oil is utilized. The presumed conventional oil supply from 2030 onwards is expected to be about 60 million barrels per day. That's the energy supply prediction for after 2030. The presumed demand at that time, looking ahead, is expected to be about 140. So the supply of about 60, demand of about 140. The gap of about 90 million barrels per day must be filled by new supply, conservation, renewable resources, the Alberta tar sands and oil shales, and I believe nuclear. The reference scenario for projects are vulnerable, dirty, and expensive global energy system. The World Energy Organization maps out a cleaner, cleverer, and more competitive energy based on new policies, energy efficiency, renewables, and nuclear. But strong political will and urgent government action is needed to create the clear incentives to change the existing investment patterns. The world oil production is near at its historical peak. Most production is controlled by national oil companies who are not part of the market economy. China and India, oil demands are increasing rapidly, and they are expected to import mainly from OPEC. However, even that supply is limited. The future demand must be satisfied by new discoveries. Tar sands and oil shale may help fill this demand. And Alberta is obviously very well positioned in this regard. But nuclear energy, we believe, can fill part of this oil gap. United Nations are on record as saying that there is no credible solution to the energy, global energy and global warming emergencies that do not include a nuclear component. At the moment in Canada provides about half of the world's supply of medical isotopes for nuclear medicine. This results in about 18 million medical procedures around the world per year. Canada supplies 75% of the world's cobalt-60, which is used to sterilize about 45% of the world's single-use medical supplies. Electrical energy in Canada over the past 15 years has grown to over a rate of over 1% per year. This includes some significant advances in conservation along the way. This results in a demand increase of about 34% by 2025. The cost of building nuclear energy capacity in Canada is competitive with coal and natural gas, and that's the Canadian Energy Research Institute's data. Both Ontario Power Generation in Ontario and Bruce Power, a private company, with the shareholders being Cameco Corporation, TransCanada Pipelines, and the Ontario Teachers Federation, have applied for licenses to build new nuclear plants in Ontario. Nuclear energy does not pollute the air. Nuclear plants produce less waste every year than a conventional plant produces every 4 minutes. Nuclear energy produces virtually none of the pollutants responsible for smog and acid rain. By using nuclear energy to produce electricity in Canada, we can avoid about 100 million tons of greenhouse gases per year. This is equivalent to all the cars driven in Canada. Currently, worldwide, there are about 435 nuclear plants in 30 countries. There are 28 reactors under construction as we speak, 64 are in the planning stages, and another 158 proposed. These are mainly in Asia and Eastern Europe. Nuclear power globally supplies about 16% of the world's energy, electricity. Nuclear power is the only large-scale generation option other than Ontario Hydro that does not release large amounts of greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming. I'd like to share with you a few slides. And that's greatly appreciated. Thank you for the light. So as we know, nuclear energy is basically powers the universe. I think you can tell that when you walk outside on a nice, hot, sunny day and you suddenly feel warmed up. It's created all the elements. So that what's happening in our fuel bundles and things like that is during our process isn't new. It's been happening since forever. And it powers our planet. We know the advantages of, as I say, a nice, sunny day outside and how we feel the heat. And for the last 40 years, it's been powering electrical plants in New Brunswick, Quebec, and Ontario, and indeed around the world. And we see here the Wolsung plant, which I had the opportunity of working at for a few years in the early 80s, Argentina, most recently China, Romania, Pakistan, and India. If we look at my other tool out here, a conventional plant from sort of the right-hand side of your picture there, I'm sure there are many of them in Alberta. You produce steam by some mechanism, and turn a generator, and out goes electricity. So today we're going to be looking at basically the reactor containment systems in the plant and how they work. Typical reactor vessel would look something like that, and you'll see what we call concrete reinforced structural steel, so big ones, and we're going to target once again just at the reactor itself. So nuclear fission, what's that about? Essentially, it's a chicken and the egg story, so I'm going to start with a slow neutron as my element to get in. It encounters natural uranium-235, causes it to fission or split. Two fission products are given off, and the heat. And that's what we're going to use to boil the water to power the turbines. And a number of fast neutrons, two or three. So heavy water or a moderator is used to slow those fast neutrons down so they can be captured by the atoms to basically cause future fissioning. If they weren't slowed down, essentially the reaction could not be self-sustaining. It's much like a spacecraft trying to come back to the Earth or land on the moon. It has to slow down in order to be drawn into the gravitational field to have that happen. And, of course, the production goes on. There's with a reactor at power, there's about 3 times 10 to the 14th. So that's 3 with 14 zeros behind it, which is kind of a big number of reactions or fissions taking place per square centimeter per second. So that's sort of a large number, but give you a bit of the idea of the magnitude of that one. During the reaction, it's important that we have one new fissioning happening for sort of every time we produce a neutron. We want to make it a steady state. To do this, we use something called control rods, which are neutron absorbers. that basically makes sure that only one neutron from each reaction goes on to cause another fission. So in that way, we can control the power. The Canadian system at the moment has a capability of refueling online, so we don't have to shut the reactors down in order to refuel them. The heat generated by the process, there you go, down in here, we're making heat obviously into a conventional boiler, producing steam which heads off to the turbine. A fuel bundle, this would be much like a fireplace log, they're about half a meter long. We look at what's inside of those. There's a number of uranium oxide fuel pellets. It's sintered, made in sort of solid pellet or solid matrix. About 10 of these pellets, if we had them, would produce all the energy you'd need for your home for a year. And that's only using a once-through process for these fuel. If we recycle them with advanced fuel cycles, that would be much longer than that. We look at this a different way. I'm going to go to the spent fuel bay for a minute. When we're done with the once fuel spent fuel bay at the moment, we basically put the fuel into the primary radiated bay. It stays there 3 or 4 years while it cools down. And then it can go into longer term either water storage or above ground dry storage at the sites. Essentially, all of the fuel at the Bruce site still remains on the site. Can-do safety. Essentially, we build robust systems. We allow for mechanical failure and human error. We train our employees very, very highly, but we assume that the odd accident will happen. We also build in systems to prevent and control them with multiple backups behind them. These test systems are tested frequently. Sometimes it's once per shift, once per day for each one of the systems. So we're making sure the systems are there and reliable. And then we're watching all the experiences in the industry and making sure that if there are any lessons learned in other plant, we learn about them and make sure that we are not susceptible to their events. Self-defense, we talked about the fuel already. Those ceramic matrices basically contain all the fission products, so it shouldn't be able to escape from that matrix. As we saw, the fuel pellets were inside steel metal tubes, zircaloy tubes, so that, and they're sealed on each end, so that they shouldn't be getting out of there. And we're then into the fuel channels, which we saw in a picture earlier, so they're within that containment system. We utilize two independent reactor control systems. So if one fails, we've always got something to keep the reactor under control. And then in addition to that, three independent ways of shutting the reactor down. These systems are automatic. They work on their own. So if anything goes is not as planned, then essentially that reactor is coming down. On the outside of it, we saw the containment structure. And then surrounding all of the plants, there's an exclusion zone and environmental monitoring, so we can make sure very sure that nothing does get outside the plant area. If we look at a typical reactor, CANDU reactor, essentially one of those could power a city such as Calgary, a million people. The total waste from that plant would go into a 10-foot cube. So the waste for a year is essentially in one cube. If I look at all the used fuel for Canada, from 1962 on for 70 years, and we're going to take that up to 2033, that could all go on to one Canadian soccer field under the height of a player. If you look at sort of as a comparison, the amount of waste contributed or pulled in by that big city in Ontario, that's one day's waste. If you look at other ones there, this one fuel bundle, again, utilizing a once-fuel process for the fuel, would supply 100 homes for about a year. If the fuel is recycled, it would be much longer than that. We look at this one bundle again, the equivalency, 400 tons of coal, if you can imagine that, 60,000 gallons of oil, and 10 million cubic feet of natural gas. And while producing this, we're avoiding much of the greenhouse gases we talked about, and resulting from the greenhouse gases, things like premature respiratory illness deaths. So all those are avoidable by, again, the use of CANDU technology. If we look at the employment for Canada, this data is probably a year or so old, a little bit old. Probably about 30,000 people in the industry, about 150 companies involved with it. Research and development to date, so $6 billion over 50 years. We quite often hear concerns that government subsidizing the industry to too great a degree. But given the benefits, even within this 1 year that you see here, that's not a bad investment, not a return on it. So $6 billion total into the industry, and in 1 year, we're basically recouping that back from the industry. If we look at the performance of the units right now, nuclear is supposed to have been on a bit of decline around the world for the last decade or so, but Atomic Energy of Canada has basically participated in the units that you can see there, and essentially on budget and on schedule. We looked at the recent experience in Kunshan, China. Essentially, they were ahead of schedule. And the last unit you see on there, Cernandova in Romania, was just brought online into commercial service in the last few months. So I think that's quite a good success story for the Canadian industry. CANDU performance, you can see some of the data right there. You see they're in service dates and the lifetime capacity factors, and I would say and improving. We continue to try to get more and more out of them as we're doing that. So again, looking at the industry, about 150 private companies. Tom Genji of Canada is our research and development. I should mention, too, the research and development is in radioactive isotopes for medical use and things like that, food irradiation. So they're pioneers in pushing the technology forward that way. The four electricity producers, New Brunswick Power, Hydro-Quebec, Ontario Power Generation, and Bruce Power. We said 26,000 jobs. That figure is actually closer to $6 billion in electricity sales at this time. Radioactive decay basically diminishes reactivity in the used fuel bundles with time. It's measured in half-lives and with only half as much activity being present after each half-life. Some radioactive nuclides have very short half-lives, and we're talking seconds, minutes, and hours. Others are measured in days, years, and thousands of years. The effect of half-life of the mixture of radionuclides coming out of the used fuel is such that after 500 years, that irradiated fuel will be no more radioactive than when it was originally mined from the Earth. The worst-case scenario for this fuel is that we may have to store it for many generations to come. Deep repositories are currently being designed and tested to this eventuality. But why would anybody bury and put out of the way a fuel resource that still had over 98% of its energy in it? Future fuel cycles, the technology of which is proven today, promises an energy supply from the current irradiated fuel for future generations lasting for thousands of years. The scenario envisions, can here sort of envisions existing sites, and this is a picture of the Bruce site. I'll give you a quick tour of that right now. Bruce B in the foreground. You may recall Douglas Point from the mid-60s. The old heavy water plant complex was in the middle. It's pretty well been removed now. And Bruce A in the background. And you may be able to pick off the big cranes that are replacing the steam generators at Bruce A in the background there. We're obviously on Lake Huron, the Great Lake. So the scenario then envisions energy complexes on existing sites, basically using the current pressurized heavy water reactors, advanced fuel cycle reactors, oxide and fuel reprocessing plants, their respective waste storage and disposal facilities, in addition to facilities such as hydrolytic hydrogen generation, heavy water production plants, synthetic fuel, gas, and oil processing plants, industrial and agricultural chemical processing plants, and agriculture and aquaculture heating facilities, all in one big self-contained energy center. By using nuclear, we also avoid depleting the world and our future generations from the future use of non-renewable fossil fuel sources, which have many other irreplaceable uses in our society, medicinal, cosmetic, manufacturing. Radiation is natural and everywhere. You and I are irradiating right now. The radiation dose to the public resulting from all the nuclear plants is much less than the regulatory limits and the radiation doses that occur naturally from all sources. As a comparison, someone living beside a nuclear plant would be getting about as much of radioactive uptake from that as drinking one glass of milk per day for 45 days during the year or eating one banana. Looking at our doses that we're receiving, and this is annual for ourselves now, and we may be a little bit more in Alberta because I think you're a little bit higher in elevation than where I'm living, but our natural uptake at the moment is probably about 2,000 microsieverts. Medicinally, we all probably receive about 1,100 microsieverts, or about half of that one. From man-made sources, it's about 80 per year. Eric Williams, working beside the nuclear plant and in the nuclear plant, probably about 60. And from living on the side of that nuclear plant, again, I live 8 kilometers from it, probably about 2 microsieverts by living there. Not a big number. In Canada's 45 years of nuclear power experience, no member of the public has ever been harmed as a result of a radiation leak from a nuclear power station or waste facility. And Canadian nuclear workers have amongst the best safety records there are. Statistically speaking, the safest thing I can do is be at work in the nuclear power plant. You may have heard that I was a paddler. Statistically, the most dangerous thing I can do is go for a short paddle. The Canadian, and I'd like to sort of talk for a minute about industry scrutiny. I think the nuclear industry is one of the most scrutinized businesses around. Watching over us on a regular basis is the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission. It's an independent federal agency. Its mandate is to regulate the use of nuclear energy and material in Canada to protect the health and safety and security and the environment, and to respect Canada's international commitments in the use of peaceful nuclear energy. CNSC retains the staff at the major nuclear facilities to ensure day-and-day compliance with the nuclear power operating licenses. Unusual events of any sort are reported to the CNSC, who will track these and make sure that they are resolved and initiate further improvements. We're also watched by our peers around the world. It's understood that any one plant encountering a problem may greatly influence all the rest of the plants around the world, as Chernobyl and Three Mile Island obviously proved. So worldwide, we have the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and the World Association of Nuclear Operators, or WANO. And most plants are striving for number one rating with WANO at this time. I know it's the Bruce's goal for 2010. Thank you. Personal note, my family arrived at the Bruce site in 1973 on a four-month training rotation. I'm still there, or we're still there. I live about 8 kilometers from the site, so I'm in the primary zone from the site. It takes me about 11 minutes to drive to work, and with no plans to basically move away from the site. So we don't really think about any risk from the nuclear site as in our day-to-day lives. As Dwayne mentioned, my son basically has returned to the industry and to the area. It's wonderful having grandchildren in town. Even though, as we're retired, we have no plans to move out of it now, and we can actually envision the day when our grandchildren will probably be able to pick up the torch and extend our nuclear family at the Bruce site. Such are the plans of Bruce Power and the confidence. Bruce Power is located on the historic shores of Lake Huron. It's nestled between the towns of Kincardine and Port Elgin. One of their major industries is the tourist industry. All kinds of wonderful sunsets, moderated temperatures because of the lakes. We won't mention the horizontal snow in the winter. These communities date back over 150 years. Douglas Point Station basically showed up there in the mid-1960s. And I think both sites, communities without exception would be commendable to the good virtues that having the nuclear site as a neighbor would be. They're wonderful supporters of all of the community's efforts. So lessons learned for myself. Obviously, I'm able to work in a beautiful community. We're 3 hours west of Toronto, out in the rural area. I've got a high-tech job, good-paying job in that community. There have been a lot of our staff are many generations in the local area. Obviously, from the community's point of view, there's new homes, churches, schools, hospitals, things like that. Community benefits from the taxes paid by the stations. It's a very stable business in the area. Sometimes the tourist towns tend to fluctuate up and down during the seasons. Spin-off businesses, many small companies working in the area supporting the industry. And again, a real one for us is my family didn't have to leave town in order to continue on with their lives. On the negative side, not all the industries in town are paying the nuclear sector wages. So somebody working at the local hamburger shop or donut shop isn't quite making the same amount. So that's a big diversity there. Housing prices could become high, and with the refurbishment programs, they're doing that at the moment. If we're not careful, the local community could become too dependent on the station. Increased supply of services, things like that. There is a concern ongoing, and it's healthy, that, you know, what are we doing with the nuclear waste and with the transmission corridors? So the nuclear industry does have its up and downs. About a decade ago, the communities reflected the news when the provincial government in Ontario shut half of the Bruce A site down. A few years later, when Bruce Power arrived on the scene, basically it turned around very quickly with the support of the communities and the refurbishment and restartup of the Bruce site. Such investors do not act without considerable research and confidence in every aspect of their investment. In the case of Bruce Power, each of these experiences and future successes has led to the next round. One must earn the right to be able to take on new projects and must continue to improve that they can achieve their targets safely, on schedule, and at protected cost. Recent announcements about the refurbishment of the Bruce project and the applications for new reactors on the site speak highly about the private investors' confidence in nuclear technology and the capable of Bruce management and staff to effect that. Alberta stands to reap the benefits of the previous experiences in Ontario's and around the world, and to surge ahead with an on-time and proven technology path. Reliability and safety has evolved over 50 years of experience with the CANDU reactors in Canada. CANDU has proved to be a very safe industry. But do not procrastinate once you have made the decision to move ahead. Get on with the job and ensure that the expensive investments yield productive results as soon as they can, such as the experiences recently in China and Korea. And based on experiences in Ontario, don't change the rules midstream, such as was the case with the Darlington station. It takes between 8 and 10 years to put a new station online. Environmental assessments, concurrent project planning, and engineering take up about half of that. So in summary then, we're not coming to the end of oil. We're coming to the end of cheap oil. Oil will only be cheap again when the world does not need it so badly. Power plants using current generation reactors must be built for a few more decades, even though the price of uranium is likely to rise. Power plants using fast reactors or future cycles can improve the long-term economics and reduce waste disposal and simplify safeguards. The future generation reactors currently available put an end to the notion that nuclear energy is a short-term option. Reprocessing will be needed. These plants can be built on existing sites. Integrated systems of current and future generation reactors can supply the world's energy needs for thousands of years to come. The later we start, folks, the harder it will be to make that transition. Thank you for your attention, and I'll look forward to taking some questions after lunch.